Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary health care services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Harvard economist David Cutler. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare looks at new research that uses mice to duplicate the immune systems of human patients. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. What does a group of motorcycle enthusiasts have to do with treating the ill in sub-Saharan Africa? As it turns out, plenty. Riders for Health is based on the premise that no one should die from a preventable or treatable disease simply because of lack of transportation. When you look at the numbers of deaths due to untreated malaria, tuberculosis, and AIDS in Africa, one of the biggest barriers to patients receiving life-saving care is transportation. Often, patients who are sick must walk long distances to reach clinics, and clinics often go without necessary medicines because of a poor delivery infrastructure. Riders for Health, an international group formed from the world of motorcycle racing, realized that if you provided a fleet of vehicles and, more importantly, put a preventive maintenance system in place, health workers would be able to take their expertise out to their populations, and medicines and other mobile devices could be transported as well.
What we do is to focus on running and managing vehicles that are able to get that health care to the people who so desperately need it.
Since the program began, over 1,000 motorcycles and four-wheel drive vehicles have been deployed across a dozen African countries. The vehicle maintenance and parts supply programs are run by local governments, and thousands of patients have been saved by this simple but ingenious concept. Riders for Health offers a transportation solution to a medical problem. Now that's a bright idea.
Today, Margaret and I are speaking with David Cutler, professor of applied economics at Harvard University, a leading expert on the economics of healthcare. Dr. Cutler served on the Council of Economic Advisors during the Clinton administration, was an advisor as well to the Obama administration. He is also author of Your Money or Your Life, Strong Medicine for American Healthcare System, which takes a historical and empirical look at the needs for healthcare reform and what it should look like. Dr. Cutler, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
You know, the nation's been through a whirlwind March Madness, if you will, at the Supreme Court on the Affordable Care Act. And based on the assessment of the High Court's hard line of questioning, either some or all of the act could be in jeopardy. It's just what seems to be the latest development in over a century of efforts to reform healthcare in America. Now, you've been actively involved in healthcare reform for over two decades. So tell us two things. Why is it so hard to bring about meaningful healthcare reform in America? And what are your observations about the hearings at the Supreme Court as well?
It's very hard because it's a complex problem. It's got a number of different facets to it. It's trying to get people to agree on things is always very difficult, and especially as politics grow more polarized. Mm-hmm. So I understand why it's taken our country so long. Nobody's happy about it, but I understand it. I thought the Supreme Court debate had some moments that were good and many moments that were discouraging. Mm-hmm. And in particular, what struck me as an economist is that a lot of the Supreme Court debate was about economics, and most of the justices did not appear to understand the basic economics of the case. So they were debating things like, externalities, which is a very, very common economic situation that applies all over healthcare, and they just got it wrong. And so they would make statements that were just incorrect. And I find it troubling that they chose to go so deeply into a substantive issue without educating themselves about the substance that they were dealing with.
Pull the thread a little on that for us, if you will.
They had a whole day's worth of discussion about, is a mandate different from a tax?
Mm-hmm.
For economists, there's really no distinction between them. That is, I could mandate that you buy health insurance, or I could say that if you don't buy health insurance, I'm going to assess you $1 million tax. My guess is those two would have the same effect. In both cases, you would have health insurance. Indeed, the mandate in the Affordable Care Act is really just a tax. But they twisted themselves into pretzels, distinguishing between the two. So a tax is clearly okay, a mandate is not clearly okay, you have to decide. Okay. So then, once they twisted themselves into that pretzel, they had to come up with reasons why the federal government might be able to intervene in the market for health insurance through a mandate where it couldn't intervene in any other market. And of course, then they would say things like, yes, but the government does intervene in the broccoli market and in the cell phone market and so on. So what's that different about? What's so different about it? And the reason why they got themselves in that situation is because they let themselves analyze the underlying economics wrong. Really, what they should have been talking about is some intervention in healthcare appropriate? The answer from every economics textbook is yes. And then, is a mandate a reasonable solution to that? And the answer to that in every economics textbook is yes. And so on the economics of this, it is absolutely a perfectly clear case. And it's only muddled if you choose to make it muddled.
So given that they have wrapped up those oral arguments, what's your projection on what happens next? Would you like to do some crystal ball gazing for us?
I wish I could, since I would make money in online betting markets. But I don't think the truth is I have no greater insight than anyone else does.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we're certainly eager to see how this plays out. And, you know, maybe while that is working its way through, I'd like to really utilize the expertise of you as a economics expert. You've spoken in your books and in your writing about reform and about value. And we recently had Dr. Berwick on our show, one of your Harvard colleagues, and both of you maintain that at least a third of all healthcare expenditures are unnecessary or flat out waste. And it seems to me that that's often translated a little simplistically into we do too many tests, we do too many duplicate tests, and all those, of course, are valid. But you've really spoken to the issue of value, not just waste, but what should we expect as a return? How do we make decisions about healthcare reform based on value? And I wonder if you'd elaborate on that concept for our listeners a bit.
Yes, thank you. It's an absolutely central issue. What we want from healthcare is not to spend less because less is always good. It's not. What we want is to get more value for our dollar. We want to be able to say when we're spending money, it's going to something that it really should be going towards. And our best guess is that about a third of the dollars in the medical care system are not going towards improved outcomes. That involves people getting too many things, like, for example, readmissions to hospitals that don't need to occur or surgeries where the literature suggests the surgery is not doing any better than non-surgical options. It involves poor prevention, as people getting sick when we could have prevented them earlier on. And it involves administrative costs that are just a nightmare. All of those are very big, important parts of the healthcare system. The question then is how to get rid of them. And there are ways to do that. It's not easy. It's not as easy as saying, oh, just import drugs from Canada because drugs from Canada are cheaper. You know, we should be able to import safe drugs where they're more cost effective. But that's not the big part of it. The big part of it is really making the system of medicine be that we doctors and other care providers can do the right thing, not the thing that pays them a lot of money. The thing that pays people a lot of money is doing more interventions, more serious things, more testing, more surgeries. The thing that is underdone that we should add to that is doing a better job preventing and thinking about the best way to treat a patient. So really what a lot of reform is trying to do is to increase the ability to do the right thing by getting rid of all the money that says do more and we'll pay you more.
You know, Dr. Culler, you've had an interesting perch on health reform attempts over the last generation at the Council of Economic Advisers, or during the Clinton administration. You were certainly engaged in the attempts to pass sweeping health care reform in the 90s. You've had a bird's eye seat in Massachusetts in the health reform initiative that's going on there, and you've been an advisor to the President Obama's administration as they've worked through the Affordable Care Act. How does the latter measure up to what you believe the ultimate needs for healthcare in America need to be?
I think that healthcare reform is going to be a process more than a single step. So what we're going to have to do is to start down the path of getting better and figure out what works and do more of that, figure out what doesn't work and make it work. So I never saw any legislation as being the final thing that we need to do. I think the Affordable Care Act does very well as the first of what will be a series of steps, not all legislative steps. That is, things that go on in the private sector with private insurance, things that happen in state governments with Medicaid programs, things that happen in physicians' offices and hospitals to allow them to do better care and with fewer resources. So I am encouraged by what we had, but realize, as everyone does, that this is the start of real healthcare reform, not the end of real healthcare reform.
Well, I think that's an excellent philosophic place to be at this moment in time. But I want to look at two things, and maybe the first one is for us to look a little bit north to Massachusetts, because from where we sit, looking at Massachusetts seems to be working quite well. And we've spoken with Dr. Gruber. He's been on our show as well. But I'd be interested from your perspective, both as an economist, as a person who works in Massachusetts, as a father and a consumer of healthcare, what's your perspective on how well health reform in Massachusetts is working and the degree to which it actually can and should serve as a model for where we go from here?
In 2006, Massachusetts decided to address the issue of coverage. So we decided we wanted to cover all the uninsured, and we put significant effort into doing that, and it worked. It worked very well. We covered 3/4 of the people who were uninsured. It cost per person about what we thought it would cost. The market has worked the way we thought it would work. There have been no deleterious impacts of that. So it's been a very big success. As a state, we put off the issue of what to do about the cost of it. We said we'd deal with that another day. That day has come. Mm-hmm. We had a huge recession, which strained our commitment to do everything in state government, including afford the coverage that we had committed to. We have the highest medical costs anywhere in the country. We had it before. We have it now. So now we are starting to address that. And it's going to be difficult. It's easier to cover people than it is to save money. I believe we will be successful. There's a lot of good will and ideas about how to do it. And the question is going to be, how do we best carry those out? Once again, I suspect the nation will be looking to Massachusetts on this, because just as it looked to Massachusetts on coverage, because Massachusetts did coverage before anyone else, I suspect the nation will look to Massachusetts on the cost dimension too. Where we're really just starting things, but where there's a lot of good stuff that's already happening.
We're speaking today with Harvard economics professor David Cutler, author of Your Money or Your Life, Strong Medicine for America's Healthcare System. He's also voted by Modern Healthcare magazine as one of the 30 people who could have a powerful impact on healthcare. Professor Cutler, you write that there are 3 major hurdles to tackle in the healthcare system: cost, access to care, and quality care. If we could, let's look at the first, cost. With healthcare expenditures approaching 20% of our nation's GDP. And yet you say focusing on containing spending isn't necessarily the right approach when you're looking at reducing costs, that value for dollars spent should be the focus. Can you pull the thread a little for us on that concept?
Yep. I know in hard economics times, most every family would like to spend less on basic necessities like food, clothing, and shelter. Mm-hmm. But not if that means their kids don't eat well, they don't have warm clothes in a cold winter, and the house leaks. So spending less is good. Spending less when you're cutting back on necessary things is not good. What we need to do is to figure out how to spend less where it's not helping us, mm-hmm. but conserve and even do more where it is helping us. And that's really the big challenge here. That's why when you say to people, save money, the first thing they think about is rationing, which nobody wants to do and we shouldn't be doing now. What we should be doing is systematically eliminating that 1/3 or so of spending, which is not associated with any better outcomes.
Professor, I had the opportunity to go back and reread your book, Your Money or Your Life, recently, and I was struck by your reference. I'm going to go to a specific area within healthcare because I think it's germane to what's going on as we look at the Medicaid expansion and how we use Medicaid as one vehicle to expand coverage and care. And you spoke about the IOM report back more than a decade now on prenatal care. And that if we invested in making sure that all women or nearly all women had access to prenatal care, the return on that investment was so huge that it was just an absolute no-brainer. And it led to significant policy change in the country, to a great increase in access to prenatal care under Medicaid. But we didn't reap the return that we thought we would in terms of birth outcomes and improvements in low birth weight. Janet, linked to another comment that you've made, that when medical interventions are developed, we're much quicker to adopt them into practice than we are when we learn about social changes or lifestyle changes or other behaviors that need to change. And as we look to a big expansion of Medicaid, if things continue on with the Affordable Care Act, what's your thoughts about how we're going to move things forward? What's the value proposition around getting people to change their behavior as an essential element within health reform?
It's an essentially important question, which is, how do you get people to use insurance the right way? One of the things we noticed in Massachusetts is that when people got insurance coverage, what they did was they used the emergency room more. And he said, why is that? They had insurance coverage. I don't understand. What were they doing in the emergency room? And the answer is, that was the only way people knew how to get care. They didn't know where primary care providers were. They weren't convenient to them. The hours weren't appropriate, and so on. So what we had was an increase in people who felt comfortable using the emergency department. That's good. They should feel comfortable. It's not a bad way to provide primary care, but it's a very bad way to think about integrating someone into the care system as a whole. So we're going to have to help people come up with ways to work through the system. And the thing that's so striking about healthcare, not just to people who were uninsured who will now get insurance, but to everyone, is how hard it is to use the system. I like to ask myself and ask others the question, which do you find more enjoyable, interacting with healthcare or buying a used car? And most people now think that buying a used car is more enjoyable.
That's
really telling you something.
That is telling me a lot.
Yes. About the state of the healthcare system and its service aspect. That's going to have to change.
And Professor Cutler, you've been talking a lot about quality of care as well in your writings, and certainly the Affordable Care Act attempted to address quality while improving healthcare accessibility. But your quality approach has drawn the praise of a number of different organizations, GE and Kaiser and others. Talk to us about what you mean when you say quality in healthcare.
I mean a couple of things by it. Number one is doing what you do so that it works. Let me give you an example of that. It used to be when you bought an American car, there was always something wrong with it. You bought it, you drove it home. Mm-hmm. 2 days later, you had to bring it back because something had to be fixed. Well, what automakers and everyone else in the world figured out is people don't like that. And it's not cheaper to do that. That is, okay, fine, you're not worrying about the problem as it's going down the assembly line, but sure enough, you're going to deal with that problem 2 days later. So quality is doing it right the first time. And in healthcare, there's a lot of not doing it right the first time. Not because people are trying. Nobody ever tries to make mistakes, but people make mistakes, and the systems aren't in place to fix that. In addition, quality is the service end of quality. That is, do you feel like you can actually use the system, or would you prefer to be interacting with the used car dealer? And then I think a third dimension is quality is avoiding stuff that you don't need to do. So in addition to doing stuff and doing it right and making it be feasible for people, it's only doing those things that you have to. And I'll just give you an example of that. It is generally believed, as attested to by most clinical studies, that approximately 90% of people with some types of back pain do not need surgery. They don't need an MRI, they don't need the orthopedist, they don't need months and months of recovery. What they need is physical therapy. And the studies are very clear on this. And yet a large number of people still have surgery because that's the way the process drives them, and nobody said, hey, look, what's actually better for this patient, better health-wise, not to mention financially, but better health-wise, is to dispense with the fancy stuff and go to the stuff that we know works right away. And that's an example of poor quality, is subjecting people to that even when they don't need it.
Professor, you recently gave a talk at the Innovations in Healthcare think tank at Harvard on whether there is hope for healthcare reform. And I think we could safely say that the picture that you painted was of a somewhat plodding system where change is slow to happen. And even as we are in this moment of suspended time with the Affordable Care Act, You mentioned earlier the good stuff was starting to happen in Massachusetts, and I wonder if you'd share with us, we talked about the coverage, the degree to which coverage has been achieved in Massachusetts, but we'd be interested in not just the coverage, but the care. What are the transformations that you see underway in Massachusetts that really, whether we get the national coverage that we hope are under the Affordable Care Act or not, what are the changes and the transformations that you see within care systems itself that should give us some cause for optimism?
The care systems are really starting to think about how do we deliver better care that people can access and that works for them. So you're seeing the big care providers saying, how do we see more people on a primary care basis, not just when they show up in the hospital? You're seeing efforts to link medical records across different settings so that information about you follows where you go from one place to another. You're seeing use of decision support services so that doctors say, aha, here's automatically the right thing to do for you. We don't have to go research it all and find out exactly what to do with this situation, but we have at our fingertips what the Library of Medicine suggests. So it's a lot of things around the idea that we need to get better at doing, at providing the care we do, because otherwise we won't be able to afford it and we will just have to cut in other ways.
Professor Cutler, we'd like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and the world, who do you think our listeners should be keeping an eye on in terms of innovations in the healthcare system?
It's a good question. You know, what I would keep my eye on is the physicians and business people who are running medium to larger size medical systems and medical groups, and their life is going to be difficult. It's going to be very, very difficult. But the question is, are they treating this as an opportunity to get better because that's what they can now do? Or are they hunkering down and hoping to ride out the storm, in which case the winds will get very stiff? And that's who I will look at to see how this is all playing out.
Mm-hmm. We've been speaking today with Harvard economist David Cutler, leading expert on health economics, author of Your Money or Your Life, Strong Medicine for America's Healthcare System, and voted by Modern Healthcare Magazine as one of the 30 people who can have a powerful impact on healthcare. Professor Cutler, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report. The lowly mouse has achieved some pretty lofty stature in the quest to find medical cures, which for researchers can often seem like a cat and mouse game. A team of researchers at Columbia University Medical Center now have a pretty mighty mouse in the house.
Here comes that mighty mouse, coming to vanquish the foe with a mighty blow.
The team, led by Dr. Megan Sykes, has developed a way to recreate an individual's immune system in a mouse. They figured out a way to take bone marrow from a patient, inject it into the immunosuppressed mouse, which then starts to grow human immune cells that are an exact match to the patient the marrow came from.
The ability to generate a new immune system from scratch from an individual patient and then manipulate it to get exactly the cells that you want to do what you want them to do when you give them back to the patient is very exciting.
Dr. Megan Sykes and her team have created a dozen personalized immunomice so far and are pretty astounded by their findings. They plan to take their research to the next level and see applications across the spectrum of fighting not only tumors and autoimmune disorders, but a whole host of illnesses. This mighty mouse discovery really could save the day for a lot of folks in the future. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report.
The mighty mouse is here today.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is a Connecting Our Communities initiative from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.